That's an epic reading, thank you, Abby. It's a big, big slice of Bible, isn't it? Just as well as daylight saving, so we've got an extra hour now. You're all mine. You think I'm joking, Vish? I don't know if you have any Friends fans in the house. The TV show Friends. Yep, a few. My favourite of the Friends is Ross. He's definitely the best, right? Like, it takes a few, you need to watch all 10 seasons 6 or 7 times at least before you warm to him, but when you do, there's just no going back. He is brilliantly played, and he gets better as you go through the seasons. He kind of develops really well. And there's an episode quite late on in the Friends kind of library where he's been overseas on holiday, and he's come back, and he's got a little girl called Emma, and he's bought her a present. I think it was like a stuffed animal or something like that. And he goes to get it out of his bag to give to her. He opens up his bag, and he just goes, why me? And you realize he's stolen the hotel, like, moisturizers and shampoos. Anybody else here do that? Yeah, he does that. He does that, but they all explode in midair, like when they're flying back, and it's just covered everything in his bag. And he just goes, why? Why do bad things happen to good people? And it's supposed to be funny. It is supposed to be funny. it's a big question, but as like they're playing it humorously. It happened this morning, actually, at the 9 o'clock service. I was there, and there's one of the guys has a dad, and he's got two little girls, and little kids get up early, and his little girls get up early. He's like, I want some me time at the start of the day, just away from the girls, but I can't get up early enough to beat them up. But then he's like, daylight savings is my moment. They'll sleep until normal time. I'll be up an hour earlier because I know the clocks have changed. And so he got up an hour earlier than his girls, and he walks into the lounge only to find out that one of their dogs had got out of his cage and there was just liquid poo everywhere. So his hour of him time was spent cleaning up poo in the lounge. And he's like, why? Why do bad things happen to good people like me, Simon? I'm like, yeah, that's tough. But there are worse things even than that in life. They can cause us to ask the question, why? Why do bad things happen to good people? And the writer of Ecclesiastes actually asks that. He points it out in verse 40, and he says, the righteous get what the wicked deserve, and the wicked get what the righteous deserve. Why? Why do bad things happen to good people? Because life isn't fair. It's not. You guys are mostly young, so you may not have discovered that yet, but you probably have. Life is not fair. Stephen King, in his book Pet Sematary, which I will never read or watch because I just read the summary of it on Wikipedia and it sounds terrifying. But he writes this. He says, life sucks, then you die. That's what he writes in that book. Life sucks, then you die. Inspirational. But it's true. And that's kind of the message of Ecclesiastes. He pretty much says, life sucks and then you die. Life is really unfair and it is hard and it doesn't make sense and then you die. That's it. And he's wrestled with the question all the way through the book. He says, well, if that is the case, is it worth being wise at all? Because if wisdom doesn't help me make sense of the mess of this life, is there any point in it? But his answer in chapter 8, verse 1, by the time he's worked his way through it to this point in Ecclesiastes, is actually yes. Have a look at chapter 8, verse 1. He says, who is like the wise? Who knows the explanation of things? A person's wisdom brightens their face and changes its hard appearance. So he's wrestled with meaninglessness and the meaninglessness of wisdom. And he's concluded, wisdom is not the silver bullet that's going to help you make sense of life. It is not. And I'm sorry, if you're trying to grow your wisdom so you can make sense of everything that happens in life, it will not help. But it doesn't mean it's worthless. Because it might not tell us the whys of life, but it does tell us the how to do life. He says, this life is unfair and it is messed up and it is hard. And wisdom will help you know how to live in this unfair, unjust, mixed up, unpredictable world. He says, wisdom is so helpful. And so he lists a whole lot of principles in these two chapters we're looking at tonight, chapter 8 and 9. Principles that help us deal with life with a bright face rather than getting hardened, because life hardens people. I don't know if you've noticed, a lot of older people, they're quite hard. It's because life's beaten them up. So how do you survive the beating up of life and not get hard? Well, the writer says, you can go through life with a bright face if you live wisely. And then he tells us how to do that. Now, this is wisdom literature. It doesn't follow the nice kind of linear logic that Paul's letters do, where he kind of builds an argument with his points and you get a nice clear conclusion. Yay. It goes around and around instead. Around and around and around. You may have noticed that if you've been here regularly. He talks about the same stuff over and again. But it's not pointless, because what he's doing every time he goes around, he's adding more knowledge and wisdom that he has learned as he does. And he stacks up that knowledge and that wisdom for us. And there's a lot of it stacked up in these two chapters. So what we're going to do, we're going to pull those different principles of wisdom, of how to do well in this life, how to make the most of it, and then we're going to apply them to a couple of areas. One is authority and one is justice. So, what are these principles? How does wisdom help us make sense of a topsy-turvy world? The first one is, do not be fooled. Wickedness is a trap. Don't be fooled. Wickedness is a trap. Because he says, wickedness can seem like it is worth it. Because it seems like people who do wickedness and bad things actually succeed and flourish in life. It actually goes well for them. That's what it looks like when you look at this world. You look at the Forbes rich list, and most of them have not got there through ethical and good means. The way to get ahead in this world, it looks like, is wickedness. And there's not a whole lot of justice, so you can thrive. And it can be very tempting to buy into, well, then wickedness is the way. And he lists a whole lot of ways here. Verse 9, he talks about people in authority who lord it over others to their hurt, and it just they don't have to answer for it. No one holds them accountable. In verse 10, he talks about people who live double lives, people who look like they're good, holy, upright people, but they are wicked underneath, and they are doing wicked things that nobody knows about. And so they're honored in life despite the fact that they're wicked, and they're honored in their death despite the fact that they're wicked. They have everybody fooled. He talks about the wicked who commit crime after crime and never get pulled up on it. Verse 12, he says a wicked person who commits 100 crimes may live a long time. It's like they just keep doing it, and no one pulls them up on it. There's no consequences. And not only does that not happen, but they actually seem to thrive and get ahead in life as a result of this repeated offending. And then in verse 14, we've already read, he said, somehow the wicked get what the righteous deserve, and the righteous what the wicked deserve. So he says, is it better to be wicked? Is wickedness the way? Is that the way to crack life? Go get yours, doesn't matter what the cost. He says, no. He says, don't be fooled, don't buy into the lie. Because wickedness is not the way. Have a look at verse 8. He says, as no one is discharged in time of war, so wickedness will not release those who practice it. It is a trap. Wickedness is a trap. It will lure you in with promises of great things, and then it will not let you go. It is dangerous, and it lies to us. And we think it's going to make our life better, but it doesn't. We think it's going to give us freedom, but it doesn't. It does the opposite. It enslaves us. The teacher assures us, wickedness is a trap, and it will not let you go. I don't know who needs to hear that here tonight. I think all of us. Because we're all tempted to buy into the lie that if we do that slightly ethically dodgy thing here, that'll be okay. If we don't tick that box on the website, and if we don't do this, it'll be okay. Nobody will know, and it's harmless, and it'll help mean I get ahead. But he says, don't do it. Do not buy into the lie that the little things you do don't matter. And do not buy into the lie that nobody else knows, so it's all okay. Because wickedness will get its claws into you, and it will not let you go. And it is a dark road to go down. We think we have power over our sin, and we think we have ability to control it, but he says that's an illusion. Sin has the power, wickedness has the power. That's the first one. The second one, which is kind of a partner principle to it, is that it will go better for those who fear the Lord. Have a look at verses 12 and 13. He says, although a wicked person who commits 100 crimes may live a long time, I know that it will go better with those who fear God, who are reverent before him. Yet because the wicked do not fear God, it will not go well with them, and their days will not lengthen like a shadow. He says it is better to fear the Lord, because it will go better for you if you do. The wicked people seem to thrive and succeed. It's a mirage, and it will not last. He says, if you want it to go well for you, you need to fear the Lord and revere him. But life does seem to contradict that, doesn't it? And he picks up on that. Did you notice the contradiction in verses 12 and 13? In 12 he says, a wicked person who commits 100 crimes may live a long time. And then in verse 13 he says, no, their days will not lengthen like a shadow. They won't live a long time. So which is it? Come on, make up your mind, teacher. Are they going to live a long time or are they not? But he doesn't alleviate the tension. He just leaves it sitting there. Because that's the brilliance of Ecclesiastes, is he teaches us the truth, but he also teaches us the reality, and he puts the two together, and he says, it is better, it will go better for you if you fear the Lord, and if you live for him. But you might not see that in life. It might take a really long time for that to be seen. His wisdom is utterly realistic about the world as it is, but it doesn't shake his faith that following and fearing God is worth it. And he is trying to build us a really robust faith that knows the truth and believes it, knows it is worth following God and fearing him. But you're not going to see in life always the results of that. It might not always seem like it when you look at the world around you. And you might see all your non-Christian friends getting ahead because they're not fearing the Lord. But he says, don't shipwreck your faith because of what you see around you. So that's the first two, the next two principles. The third one kind of follows that. Life just doesn't make sense. And don't expect it to make sense. That's the tension all the way through Ecclesiastes, and he sums it up really well in chapter 8, verse 17. He says, no one can comprehend what goes on under the sun. Despite all their efforts to search it out, no one can discover its meaning. Even if the wise claim they know, they cannot really comprehend it. His life is beyond our comprehension. And if you try and work it all out and pair up these seeming contradictions, you're just going to go crazy. Because you're not going to be able to answer the why questions, not all of them. There's going to be stuff you just aren't able to comprehend. Even the wise cannot comprehend it. In fact, the wise are the people who know they can't comprehend it, and they're like, that's okay, because I don't know everything, and I can't know everything. And that's fine. And they make their peace with that. That is one of the reasons their faces are bright. Because they don't tangle themselves in knots and get all bitter and twisted trying to work out how things in this world fit together when they actually don't. When I was in Bible college in London in O week, orientation week, they got us all together in the main lecture hall. And it had a wall kind of similar size to that. It was just this massive, massive whiteboard. And the dean for the college got up. And he said, imagine this wall, it's all you could know in this world. And then he got a whiteboard and he said, here's how much we think roughly you guys know at the moment. And he just drew this tiny little circle on the whiteboard. And you're like, well, that's insulting. And then he said, you guys are going to spend 3 or 4 years, some of you five years, studying here. By the end of that time, how much more do you think you're going to know? And he drew an ever so slightly bigger circle. And you're like, that's what I'm paying all my fees for? That much more? But he said, what we're interested in here is teaching you wisdom. We're not just trying to teach you more in that circle. We're actually trying to teach you how much you don't know. We're trying to give you awareness of how little you know and how much there is out there. Because it makes you humble. And it allows you, like the teacher says here, to actually just go, it's okay, I don't know everything and I can't put it all together and life isn't going to make sense to me, but that's okay. That's the third principle. What's the fourth? It kind of flows straight from that. Humbly trust God, and that will bring contentment and joy. Verses 16 and 17, he says, when I applied my mind to know wisdom and to observe the labor that is done on earth, people getting no sleep day or night, then I saw all that the Lord has done. You see, through Ecclesiastes, he's made it his study to look at people and what they are doing and how this world fits together. He has watched people and he goes, it doesn't make sense. And then finally, it's like the light comes on. He goes, I'll stop looking at people and I'll start looking at what God has done. And that's when it starts to get easy for him. That's when his face brightens. That's when the knots come untangled. He doesn't get it all. It still doesn't make sense, but he knows that God does. And that is so freeing for him. In his wisdom, he's realized, I don't need to know everything, and I won't be able to know everything. But God does. And he acts perfectly on it. And so he says in chapter 9, verse 1, I reflected on all this and concluded that the righteous and the wise and what they do are in God's hands. But no one knows whether love or hate awaits them. It's in God's hands. The righteous and the wise and what they do, they're in God's hands. And so he doesn't need to know. He doesn't need to be able to work it all out. Because he knows that God has worked it all out and God does know. And he can trust him with it, safe in God's hands. And there is so much calmness and peace that comes from knowing that. That's why chapter 8, verse 1, he says, wisdom brightens our face and changes our heart appearance. It's just so freeing. You can take the burden off you that you can't carry anyway and just trust him who can. One of the writers put it like this, the same God who assures us that he is lovingly guiding every moment of our lives through thorny ways to a joyful end also assures us that we will never in our earthly lives see how. We won't get it. He says, real wisdom lies in acknowledging and accepting this and in turning to the enjoyment of the present task. He says, stop trying to work it all out. You can ask the why questions, but don't get tangled up in knots trying to find the answers. Trust that God knows and be okay with that. So that's our four principles in how to live life well as a wise person. The teacher applies it to a couple of areas. One is authority and one is justice. And probably it's more accurately misused authority and injustice. So how does he do it? What does he teach us through those principles? Authority first. He talks about kings, but it's equally applicable, I think, to employers, governments, things like that. It's just talking about authority. And he says, have a look at verse 2. Obey the king's command, I say, because you took an oath before God. Do not be in a hurry to leave the king's presence. Do not stand up for a bad cause, for he will do whatever he pleases. Since the king's word is supreme, who can say to him, what are you doing? And sometimes you might want to say to people in authority, what are you doing? What's his advice? Obey those in authority. Don't try and undermine them. And don't practice any kind of wickedness to get round them or overthrow them. Fear God as the one who has put them there. Trust that he knows why, and don't get sucked into bad and wicked ways of trying to usurp them or get past them. They've been put there by God. And if you want a study of how to do that, if you're like, what does that actually look like? Go and read Daniel chapters 1 to 6. Because that is what Daniel does. He is so wise. And he takes the four principles here, and that's how he lives. He lives in a foreign land under an all-powerful king who was not good and who could have cut off his life like that. If he's having a bad day, Daniel could be gone. So how does Daniel live under that king? He lived without resorting to wickedness. He continued to fear God and obey him. He recognized it wouldn't make sense. He wouldn't be able to understand why life was the way it was, but he trusted that God did, and that was okay. And you see that lived out in Daniel chapters 1 to 6, so go and read it. And you might say, well, what does that mean? Does that mean I just have to obey everything the government and my boss and everybody else says? Well, not necessarily. Verses 5 and 6 says, whoever obeys the king's command will come to no harm, and the wise heart will know the proper time and procedure. For there is a proper time and procedure for every matter, though a person may be weighed down by misery. He is saying there is a time and a place and a way to challenge authority. It's actually okay. You're allowed to do it. But there is a proper time and a proper way to do it, which is not disobeying. It is not resorting to wickedness or standing up for a bad cause. It is fearing God, obeying the authority he has put in place. And when you get the time and the way to do it, then you can stand up and challenge it. But only that way. So that's authority. What about justice? Which is quite closely linked, isn't it? And he says justice is good. Justice is a good thing, verse 11. When the sentence for a crime is not quickly carried out, people's hearts are filled with schemes to do wrong. In other words, when justice is slow, it's not much good, because people just carry on doing stuff. So when you find out that you can get away with driving 55 and a 50 and no cop's going to pull you over, whereas actually a friend who was a cop, a friend of mine, says no cop's going to pull you over for doing 60. It's like, oh, now I can go 60. So that's the thing, right? You go, now I can do 60, and that'll be okay. But that's the problem with justice. If it's not swift, people think they can get away with things, and their minds start to go, what else can I get away with? So justice is good, but actually it's so limited. It's so limited in this world, and there is injustice everywhere. And that's what he spends the rest of his time talking about. He talks about the injustice that comes from here on. It's all about injustice, not good justice. And so how do you live in a world where injustice is just everywhere and unfairness is everywhere? We've got our four principles. And I thought I'd share a personal example of this because it's been very poignant for me in the last week. So 6.5 years ago, my sister died or was killed. We actually don't know. It's part of the problem. It was a mysterious, distressing... there was so much we didn't know about her death. And the big questions were, was it self-inflicted or was it inflicted upon her? And that's really hard. If you've lost anyone and you don't know the answers to those sorts of questions. And we tangled ourselves up in knots trying to work it out. And the police did so much investigating and interviews and all sorts of stuff. And at the end of roughly a year with affidavits and everything else, we still didn't know. The police wouldn't tell us what they'd found. They just forwarded it to the coroner. And to make matters worse, her partner at the time, who we thought may have killed her, was also listed as the executor of her will, which meant that he was the one who decided, kind of divided up her stuff and made sure it went to the right places. Problem was, he could only do that role, as specified in the will, if he was her fiancé. And we knew a couple of days before that he had called off the engagement and was planning on moving back to Auckland. So we knew he wasn't, but he lied about it. And we couldn't prove otherwise, therefore he could be the executor of her will. And we know he was dishonest in how he separated things out. And he stole a lot of stuff he shouldn't have. And he got away with it because we couldn't prove anything. And say, where's the justice? Fast forward 6.5 years later, and 1 week ago, we get a message from the coroner saying finally he's looking at the file for my sister's case to try and work out what happened. Like 6.5 years. 6.5 years of not knowing and feeling injustice has been done. And that just happened to be at the exact same time that I started looking at this passage to prepare it for the sermon, not knowing what was coming. Can you believe it? And I thought that was some kind of sick joke on God's behalf. I was like, what? What are you doing? You're churning up all this stuff, this hurt and this pain and these questions of why and what that we don't have answers to. At the same time, you're giving me a passage to speak on injustice and death. But it wasn't a sick joke. It was loving wisdom of God. You see, God knew I needed to hear these four principles and work through it in a godly way. He knew this is what I needed to hear. And so I'm going to work through what I learned from those four principles in that situation. Hopefully it's going to be helpful for you thinking through what it means to live wisely in very tough situations. So the first principle, wickedness. I've got to say, if you feel like injustice has been done to you, and you may have experienced this, what do you want to do? You want to take matters into your own hands, and you want to make sure justice is done. You do. And you can get petty, or you can get violent, or you can get in some other ways wicked. And it is very, very tempting. When someone's hurt you deeply and you feel that justice has not been done, what you want to do is get a baseball bat and go and make sure it is. But the writer to Ecclesiastes rightly says, do not go down that road. Because wickedness will not release those who practice it. It is a trap. Don't go there. And I needed to hear that. The second one, it will go better if I fear God, is similar. When you feel like someone's got away with something and they can continue to get away with it, you don't really want to fear God with your thoughts and your words and your actions. You don't want to do the right thing. The temptation is to act in a displeasing way, it is to think in a displeasing way, and it is to speak in a displeasing way to God. You don't really want to fear and revere him in what you say and think and do. But the writer of Ecclesiastes says, continue to fear him even when it's really tough, because it is worth it. It will go better for you. These are promises. It will go better for you if you fear the Lord, no matter how hard that might be to do and how much you don't want to do it. And I needed to hear that. I also needed to be reminded of, guess what, it doesn't make sense and it won't be fair. You're not going to be able to work it out. And you can ask the why question for the rest of your life and not get answers to it. And we have asked the why question over and over. And I noticed it's weird. I thought I'd put it down and let it go. And then this came up. And all the same stuff came. And just your mind is whirring at 1,000 miles an hour. And your heart is beating. And you're trying to work it out. And he said this and she did that. And then we saw that. And there was this thing there. And you're trying to put it all together and work it out and come to an answer. And we're no closer now than we were 6.5 years ago. And the wise person says, look, you've tried, but that's okay. You can't put it together. You can make your peace with that. We won't know, but he does. And that's okay. Sometimes that's okay. And that's all you've got. And so you conclude in chapter 9, verse 1, as you reflect on all this, that the righteous and the wise and what they do are in God's hands. You can trust him. They are trustworthy hands. And I needed to hear that. I needed to be reminded that I can trust that he knows what has gone on. That situation and my family and my sister, all in his hands. I needed to be reminded that joy and comfort isn't found in trying to work it all out or taking matters into my own hands, but in trusting him who is working it out and who does know. That was what I needed to hear. I need to remember that God has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed, the Lord Jesus Christ. Justice will be done. And so I need to make sure I am steering clear of wickedness and fearing the Lord and trusting him, because I know when justice is one day done, it will go better for me. There's little that's fair in this life. If you live long in it, you will experience injustice. You'll know its harshness and the illogical nature of what happens. And there'll be times where maybe you're on the receiving end of it, when someone continues to get away with something over and over again, maybe they have for you, and you'll know it can be painful, deeply, deeply painful and hurtful. And it can cause us to risk our faith, to shipwreck it, because we get so desperate for answers and so twisted up inside that we turn to wickedness instead of our Lord. But the writer says, don't do that. It's a trap. Continue to trust the Lord. Fear him. And that is how it will go well for you. That is how you can keep a smile on your face when life is just an absolute painful shambles. Because he's got it, and you're in his hands. Why? Why me? Why do bad things happen to good people? We will destroy ourselves trying to work out the answers to those questions. We're much better to trust God with it and be humble. That's what the teacher says, humbly trust God and fear him. Joy isn't found in trying to work it all out, but in trusting him who is. Now, you might be thinking, that was a refreshingly short sermon from my usual Tim Capel sermons. But that's all a trap too, because we're only halfway through the text. We haven't even touched chapter 9, well, verse 1. But don't worry, chapter 9 is all just one principle, and it's a really easy one. You're going to die. That's what he says. Death is coming for you. He says, for all the unpredictability of life, of not knowing whether love or hate awaits us, of not understanding the wise, he says, death is coming for you, and you can be sure of that. That's the one thing in life that's guaranteed. He says, you might not know when, you might not know how, but it's coming. He says, death is no respecter of person. Have a look at verse 2. He says, all share a common destiny, the righteous and the wicked, the good and the bad, the clean and the unclean, those who offer sacrifices and those who do not. As it is with the good, so with the sinful. As it is with those who take oaths, so it is with those who are afraid to take them. This is the evil in everything that happens under the sun. The same destiny overtakes all. The hearts of people, moreover, are full of evil, and there is madness in their hearts while they live. And afterward, they join the dead. We're all going to join the dead. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow. But someday, it'll happen. It's coming. And so he says, verse 4 to 6, he says, life is better than death, isn't it? Have a look at verse 4. It says, anyone who is among the living has hope. Even a live dog is better off than a dead lion. For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. They have no further reward, and even their name is forgotten. Their love, their hate, and their jealousy have long since vanished. Never again will they have a part in anything that happens under the sun. He says, life is better than death because the dead can't do what the living can and will never be able to do again. And so how do we live our life? He says, verses 7 to 10, so go, eat your food with gladness and drink your wine with a joyful heart, for God has already approved what you do. Always be clothed in white and always anoint your head with oil. Enjoy life with your wife whom you love all the days of this meaningless life that God has given you under the sun, all your meaningless days. For this is your lot in life and in your toilsome labor under the sun. Whatever your hands find to do, do it with all your might. For in the realm of the dead where you are going, there is neither working nor planning nor knowledge nor wisdom. He says, make the most of the life that you have while you have it. See, unlike earlier in Ecclesiastes, when his kind of investigation into death just led to absolute despair, now he says, actually, death isn't a cause of despair, it's a catalyst for joy. It's a reminder to make the most of the life that you have while you have it. He says, the dead have no more part to play in what happens under the sun, but you do. And so enjoy what God has given you while you can. Which doesn't sound very New Testament Christian-y, does it? Aren't we supposed to like make sacrifices and not enjoy anything in this world because heaven's where we enjoy stuff? It doesn't seem to fit with what the Apostle Paul says in Philippians 1, to live as Christ and to die as gain. Surely it's death we're striving for, that's what we're going to enjoy. Sounds like they contradict each other, but they don't. They both agree. Because Paul goes on to say, in Philippians 1, that he's convinced he's going to live, and he's going to live because he's going to be useful to God, and he's going to work with all of his might to serve God's people for their joy. They're just emphasizing different things. And so how do you make the most of the life that you have? He says, first of all, enjoy what God's given you, the material possessions. He says, it's not sinful to enjoy them. It's sinful to worship them and love them. It's sinful to be selfish with them. It's sinful to misuse them. It's sinful to be thankless in your use of them. But it's not sinful to enjoy them. It's right. Enjoy what God has blessed you with and be generous with it. Enjoy your relationships, especially those core deep relationships that you have. Enjoy them because they too are a gift from God. And enjoy what you do and work at it with all of your might. Give yourself to whatever work God has given you to do. He says, don't wish it all away. And it's a curious tendency, I think, that Christians have. We long for heaven so much that we don't enjoy what God's given us now, as if somehow the blessings he gives us now are less holy than the blessings he will give us then. That's weird, isn't it? No, they're not less holy. They're just like the taste of what's to come. If you go to a restaurant and they offer you a little hors d'oeuvre or starter, they're doing that to warm your palate up and get you excited about what is to come, because what is to come is so great. And that's what these blessings are like in this life. God's given them to us to warm our palate up and get us excited for what is to come. Both materially, relationally, connection with him, all of it. And so he says, enjoy it. Because if you're not going to enjoy it now, why would you enjoy it later? Enjoy what he's given you. The teacher says, don't be so obsessed with death that you forget to live. Instead, remember death so that you live. While God keeps you here on earth, make the most of the time that you have here, which will include serving him with all of our might, and we need to make sure we're doing that, redeeming the time because the days are evil, and it will also mean enjoying what he has blessed us with. It's key to remember at this point that the writer to Ecclesiastes, he has a very tight remit and focus. He is focused on what happens where under the sun, on this earth, in this life. That is his focus. And so he spends all of his time trying to understand what is going on under the sun in this life, before death. And it's not like he's saying there's nothing after death. In fact, if you go, spoiler alert, if you go into chapter 12, he says he knows that when we die, our spirits go back to God and we are judged. He knows there's something to come. It's not like he's ignorant of that. But that is not his focus. His focus in Ecclesiastes is this life here and now and trying to make sense of it and trying to live wisely in it. He leads us to the point of death, but he leaves us there. The rest of the Bible doesn't. It carries on. It talks about what comes after. Jesus, the great teacher, he says there is a resurrection. Death ends your days under the sun, but it doesn't end your days. But believing in the resurrection doesn't contradict what the teacher says here. It just adds to it. And so as we close, there's just one little verse with so much wisdom that I just want to pull a little bit from. Chapter 9, verse 4. Have a look at it with me. He says, anyone who is among the living has hope. Even a live dog is better off than a dead lion. Now, that sounds odd to us because dogs are special. I don't know if you've got a dog. You probably think it's special. And a dog's life in our culture now is pretty good. Like, for most of them, they get a nice warm place to sleep. They're well fed. They don't have to hunt for their meals. They're taken on walks. Like, they behave badly and they get away with it. Like, it's a great life. But back when this was written, it was not a great life for a dog. It is not a dog's life back then. Back then it was tough. They were unclean and people didn't want them and didn't want to have contact with them. They didn't feed them. The dogs had to go and forage on their own. They were just wild dogs mostly. Life as a dog sucked back then. And yet he says still, better to be a live dog than a dead lion. And lions, they were noble. They're like the king of beasts, right? But still better to be a lowly, unclean dog that no one wants and alive than a dead lion. Why? Because the dead have no hope. Death is the end of hope for everyone, Christian and non-Christian alike. Once you die, you will not hope. You'll have none. If you die apart from Jesus, not trusting in him, not reconciled to God, there is no hope that things will ever get better for you once you die. That is the end of hope, which just sounds terrifying to me, spending the rest of your existence without hope. It means the chaotic, confusing, unjust days of this earth are as good as it will get for you. Your best days will be behind you. And these days ain't even that good. Because after death, there's no more hope of making things right with God. But as the writer to the Hebrews says, only a fearful expectation of judgment and of raging fire that will consume the enemies of God. And that is why what the teacher says here is so wise. He says death is the catalyst, it's the reminder to make the most of this life while you have it. And if you are not a Christian, that means getting things right with God now while you are alive. If you don't trust in Jesus yet, it's not too late. Most of you still look relatively alive out there. And if you are alive, there is hope. There is time to fear God and trust in Jesus and get right for the next life. Psalm 2 says something kind of weird, but it says, kiss the Son, that's Jesus, lest he be angry and you be destroyed in your way. For his wrath can flare up in a moment. But blessed, happy are all who take refuge in him. It says, if you come back to Jesus and make things right with him, you will be happy, both now and for eternity. So while you have life in you, do it. Make the most of the time you have left by getting right with God. You've got time to turn it around. So do it. That's the hope of the gospel of Jesus. While you have life, you have hope. And if you have non-Christian friends and family who are not currently right with Jesus, while they are alive, there is hope. So pray for them and talk to them. Because where there is life, there is hope. But they will disappear in death. For Christians too, but for a different reason. You see, Romans 8 says, who hopes for what they already have? And once Jesus' people die, when Christians die, they will have everything they ever wanted. They won't have to hope for anything anymore because they will have it. See, our very best days under the sun, enjoying food and life, they're just nothing compared to what is to come. In your very worst days, the chaos, the injustice, the oppression, the hardship, they'll be gone forever. Dear Christians don't need to hope for a better future because we'll be living it when we die. And the writer of Ecclesiastes says, in the meantime, we hope as we wait for that patiently, and we make the most of the life we have been given now. Let me pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you so much for the book of Ecclesiastes. Like the rest of your word, it contains so much wisdom we desperately need to hear. Thank you that it's so real about this world. It doesn't pretend like everything's going to be all right in this life. It's realistic about the fact that it is messy and it's unjust and unfair and it's hard and it won't make sense. But thank you for the reminder that that's okay. We don't need to understand because we know you do. Please help us to trust you with that. Please help us to not doubt that and turn instead to wickedness to try and work things out or to make our way. Please help us instead to fear and trust you. And thank you for each person in this room, including myself, who still have life, because while we have life, we have hope in this world. I pray you'd help us to think about what it looks like for us to live the best life now in preparation for the future while there is still hope. Thank you for the gifts you shower on us. Please help us to enjoy them the way you say and to thank you for them and to recognize that it's a pointer of what you have in store for those who love you in the future. We pray that in Jesus' name. Amen. I'm supposed to say something about slips now. You got slips on the thing you were given when you came in. If you've got any questions, if there's if you don't get the newsletter and you want to sign up to our Church Bites newsletter, if there's any groups you want to join, if you want to be a youth group leader, write it on there, tear it off, and that'll be collected after the last song. Thanks.